This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Among the words used to describe her, mean, dull, lacking in charm, vain, and vituperative. But Harriet Taylor Mill, a philosopher, women's rights advocate, and wife of philosopher and political economist John Stuart Mill, has her defenders, among them Jo Ellen Jacobs, a distinguished professor of philosophy at Millikan University. Professor Jacobs argues that Harriet and John collaborated extensively, and Harriet had influence on John's philosophical works, including on liberty. We'll talk more about Harriet Taylor Mill and her work with her husband, John Stuart Mill, in this portion of the program. Jo Ellen Jacobs is our guest. Listeners, I look forward to your telephone calls this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jo Ellen Jacobs is the author of The Voice of Harriet Taylor Mill. Those descriptions of Harriet I mentioned a moment ago come from the opening of that book, where Jacobs quotes from a number of sources from the 19th and 20th centuries that use those words to describe Harriet Taylor Mill. Professor Jacobs is also the editor of The Complete Works of Harriet Taylor Mill. She is Griswold Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at Millikan University Indicator. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome.
Hello.
It's so good to talk with you about this woman. What an interesting woman. Who said those things about Harriet Taylor Mill, and did those words at all describe her?
Well, no, they don't describe her. They were said by biographers, primarily of John Stuart Mill, and they've been said from the time that she was alive until less than 5 years ago. So it's the whole history of philosophy that has characterized her that way.
Why?
Well, she was very angry. She was a very angry woman, and anger and women don't go together. She wasn't a polite lady in that sense. She was angry at all kinds of ideas, at things like child abuse and child custody judgments, conformity, domestic violence, the French Revolution. But she was also exasperated at people, her children, her husband, her lover, John Stuart Mill. I mean, she had the audacity to be angry at probably one of the brightest human beings ever to have lived, John Stuart Mill. At one point, she said, after he had complained that perhaps she might have damaged his career or their relationship, and she responds by saying, "Good heavens, have you at last arrived at fearing to be obscure and insignificant? Mm-hmm. What can I say about that? But by all means, pursue your brilliant and important career." She just had no inhibition about telling him that, you know, she was suffering too here.
Mm. Was she at all respected in the 19th century for her thinking, for her writings? Who admired her work?
Well, a number of people. The most important thing that she wrote that was recognized at the time as hers was The Enfranchisement of Women. And it was one of the best-selling tracts in the U.S. for the suffragette movement. So it became a very important work in its own right, and it was recognized, at least in the United States, as her work, as Mrs. Mill's, because at that point they had married. Now, the reactions to it ranged from people like Bronte, Charlotte Bronte reacted to it, Freud reacted to it, even Nietzsche, which seems almost inconceivable. And Nietzsche, in many ways, took it as the ideal of his notion of what a marriage would be like, which is anyone who knows Nietzsche would think this is bizarre to think that he would have taken this woman's opinion as being the right one in terms of how to think about women. and men together.
Yeah. I think what we need to do is back up a little bit and get some background on John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill, and it's kind of an involved story. But before we get to those questions, I've got to ask you, what led you to your interest in Harriet Taylor Mill?
Well, it's a long story. Because I teach at Millikan University, which is a small private college, I often taught an honors seminar that included Victorian women literature. Well, I'd never been trained in literature as a philosopher, and so I decided to spend a summer studying nothing but Victorian women's literature in Oxford. And while I was there, of course, the name John Stuart Mill kept coming up over and over and over again. And, of course, I'd read On Liberty, and I pulled it back out and read the dedication, which was to Harriet Taylor. And I thought, it'd be interesting to know something more about her, since I am a philosopher. So I went to the Bodleian Library, which is the largest library in the world, went to the reference librarian and said, you know, can I find out more about her, where papers of hers might be or letters? And she said, well, it would be in the biographical dictionaries because they're just, you know, whole walls full of biographical. I mean, everybody, I mean, the washmaid had a biographical dictionary. But we went there and there was nothing on Harriet Taylor Mill. I mean, nothing wasn't even mentioned. And well, even as wife of John Stuart Mill, she should have been there, right, but she wasn't. So the librarian said, well, next time you're in London, there's a women's history library. And so I went there and nothing under Harriet. But under John Stuart Mill, now notice this is a women's history library, but they have an entry for John Stuart Mill because of his own work for feminism. But listed among his works was the Mill Taylor Collection, which was at the London School of Economics. So I thought, well, at least the name's there. So I went over to the London School, of economics into their archives and went up to this fairly smallish room and said, well, could I see all the works of Harriet Taylor Mill, if you have anything from Harriet Taylor Mill? And they said, well, how much? And I said, well, everything you've got. And they started bringing out these huge boxes of stuff. And I mean, they had passports and pictures and scraps of papers and letters just piled in boxes. And I was stunned at this. And I asked the librarian who had been there since the Second World War, well, who's transcribed this? And she said, nobody. Hmm. I mean, no one had transcribed it. So this was in the late 80s. And I was shocked that no one had done anything about this. And so that's what led to the first book, which was the actual transcription of all of everything she'd written. Her letters, the notes, the poems, the articles, everything that was there.
Yeah, and then later comes the biography.
Right. Then after I completed the complete works, then I could think, because I'd been through all of this, because I didn't start out as a Mill scholar. I mean, I was trained in aesthetics, which is a philosophy of art, so this was not something I had intended to do. It's just that I was so appalled that no one had done it, that I felt someone had to do it.
Yeah. Now, do you teach a course at Millikan on her?
I have on occasion.
On occasion,
yes.
What resonates with your students about her?
Well, she is, I mean, all of her ideas are relevant in the sense that she was convinced that human development required women's equality, and that women's equality would require two different kinds of things. One, it would require certain kinds of legislative actions. Laws and institutions would have to be changed. So we would need to get divorce, and women would have to have the right to own property. They'd have to have access to education. They'd have to have access to careers. And from her point of view, both before and after they were married, they had to have the right to do that in order to be able to assure that they had money, which would then assure that they could get a divorce if they wanted to. So it was all linked together. Mm. Now, most of those things have actually happened since her time. But the interesting thing was that she thought that that in and of itself would not be enough. She thought that it would require a change in how the personal lives of men and women were lived together. That meant in the bedroom, in the house. So it would require a change in the politics of the family.
Now, what were John Stuart Mill's ideas about this?
Well, John was radical, but not as radical as she was. So he was a ardent supporter of women's rights even before he met Harriet. So it was one of the things that drew them together. It wasn't as if he got it from her or she got it from him. They were both dedicated to women's equality prior to meeting each other.
And they worked together, they talked together, they thought together, they collaborated.
Yes.
Okay, now, let's go back to Harriet's earlier life. How did she come to be such a radical thinker?
Well, she was raised as a Unitarian, and the Unitarians at that time were the most radical group. I mean, so her father was a man midwife, which was not all that uncommon at the time, and they were a fairly modest family, but the Unitarians believed more than anyone at the time in women's equality, and they were essentially an alternative way of looking at the world because they weren't Church of England. They were already outsiders. They weren't allowed to go to school with ordinary children. So she was raised in an atmosphere that was already liberal.
Okay. What kind of daughter was she?
Well, she and her mama had their times.
She was angry from the beginning, huh?
Yeah. Her mother was kind of cranky, and I think she was pretty feisty, so they didn't always get along all that well.
Yeah. Now, John Stuart Mill was her second husband. Her first husband was John Taylor, and they married when Harriet was 18. The year was 1826. Who was he?
John Taylor was a pharmacist, essentially, is what we would call him now. And he was a Unitarian, and we don't have any evidence about whether they knew each other prior to getting married. It was probably arranged through friends of theirs who are all Unitarians. They had quite a loving relationship for the first 3 or 4 years of their marriage. We don't have a whole lot of evidence of that, but just we have one letter and a few poems, and they all seem to be very loving.
Mm-hmm.
But that changed dramatically when she found out that she was pregnant the third time.
She had three children. Why the third time? Why the shift?
Well, I speculate that it's because she found it at that point that she had syphilis. At 30, John Taylor was probably not a virgin. I mean, we talk about the 40-year-old virgin. Well, he was not a 30-year-old virgin. And at the time in London, syphilis was uncurable and rampant. So if he, in fact, used prostitutes, and they were, as I said, widely used, it wouldn't have been unusual. And the doctors, if he had known that he had syphilis, doctors would have told him that he could not give it to his wife. So he may not have been a horrible human being in the sense that mm-hmm. he had some disease that he hid from her or in any other way. It may have just been a kind of a horrible accident.
Okay. So in the 1820s, to be unmarried at age 30, that, you know, coupled with what was probably not talked about a whole lot, but what probably was common practice could have been that he had relations with prostitutes.
Right. I mean, some scholars have estimated that there were 80,000 prostitutes in London alone at that time.
What was Harriet's view of prostitution?
Well, this is, again, one of the reasons, I mean, one little piece of evidence that I think that she probably had it is that she actually wrote about it, and this would have been unheard of. And about the time that I speculate that she found out, she writes about the fact that she thinks 3/4 of the adult male population saw prostitutes. And for her to have had any notion of that, to even have speculated about the percentages or anything like that, suggests a knowledge of it that would have been unusual, even among a young married woman. I mean, this is a woman who at the time was 22, 23.
So even for a young Unitarian woman,
right,
this would have been unusual,
right,
unheard,
yes,
of.
Yes.
Okay. What kind of mother was she?
she has been lambasted for her mothering skills. Again, along the lines, I could give you a list that mimics the one you mentioned at the beginning. I think she was a very, very fine mother, particularly to Helen. Helen was her only daughter. Particularly when you look at her early 20s, Helen wanted to go on the stage, which was at the time a very risque thing to do. The connection between prostitution and people in the theater was still quite strong. And yet Helen was determined to do this and determined to do it on her own, to go and to do it professionally, not just sort of in the quiet of private...
In the parlor.
No. And despite Harriet's dislike in general of being out in public, this was particularly difficult, and yet she supported her. She gave her the money to do it. She went with her and helped her arrange living places for her to stay while she was performing, and gave her advice, very practical advice on how to do it.
Yeah. What about her sons?
Her sons, start back at the beginning. After this crisis, when she found out she was pregnant, for whatever reason, whether it was syphilis or something else, she, in about 2 years after that, left John Taylor's house. So she was set up in her own private house. Now, the children went back and forth between the houses. But the two boys primarily stayed with him, whereas Helen stayed primarily with her. And so she wasn't as close a mother to them. Mm-hmm. And of course, the tradition was for them to go off to boarding school, which they did fairly early on as boys.
Was that separation something that was unusual? No.
Well,
not for the children and for the boys to go off to boarding school, but I mean for John and Harriet, this being John Tyler.
Yes. Oh, quite radical.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were other people at the time who had public breaks. And she really walked a tightrope here because she wanted to have her cake and eat it, too, if you will. She wanted to maintain a public marriage so that she did not lose her children, nor did she create scandal for John Taylor. But at the same time, she wanted to continue this love relationship with John Stuart Mill. And he had a public face, and he was a well-known editor and philosopher, and he was by the end the head of India House, which was a very public position. So he had this. It was very difficult for them to find a way to maintain both of those things, and yet she managed.
How and when did Harriet Taylor meet John Mill?
I think within the month of her becoming pregnant. So they were both 24 at the time.
Okay. And so they meet one another and they develop a friendship. But you're hinting here at maybe there was some adultery. Was there an affair?
It depends on what you mean by adultery.
Sure.
My guess is that they did not have sex. Nearly everyone chides John in the history of philosophy for being essentially undersexed, not that he had an affair. And there's reason to suspect that they were right in the sense that when John and Harriet were talking about how to characterize their relationship when he was writing his own autobiography, right at the end of Harriet's life, Harriet writes to him privately and says, look, we should just be honest and we should say, we had this loving relationship, but there was no sex. And there would be no reason for her to have said that if it weren't true. And so my guess is that she was telling the truth and that they didn't have sex. But they had everything but. I mean, it's not just sort of theoretically falling in love. They talk about holding hands and kissing, and they want to kiss each other's letters, and they... At one point, she says, I want to kiss your sideburns. And he had notoriously long sideburns. So it was clearly very erotic. But again, if she had syphilis, they had a very good reason never to consummate it.
Yeah. Yeah. That, when you say erotic, I happen to note on your Vita that you have written a paper, I believe, called Erotic and Chaste.
Right.
Both at the same time, which is maybe something that's hard for us to get our minds around.
But. Right. And I think it was actually in trying to understand that kind of, I don't know, lusty chastity that I started thinking more about the symptoms and the medicines she was taking. And then I started doing research at the Wellcome Institute. And when I started realizing that the kinds of medications they prescribed were exactly what she was taking for syphilis, then the light went off and I went, wait a minute. And the more I investigated the whole notion of syphilis, the more it made sense why they would be both erotic and chaste simultaneously. Mm.
When did this, if we could call it an affair, when it moves beyond, you know, friendship after their meeting, how did this begin? And, you know, how did they begin thinking about how do you negotiate a friendship at this time in history while Harriet is married to John Taylor?
Well, they met. At least the myth is, and I think there's some reason to believe this, at a dinner party at the Taylors. So John Taylor and Harriet, his wife at the time, invited John Stuart Mill and a few of his friends and William Fox, who was a very famous Unitarian at the time, and their minister, to a dinner party. And they met at that dinner party, and it was quite clear that and she had just found out she was pregnant. So this is all, you know, the November, the late 1830, so the end of the year, and Helen was born in July, and I happen to have a daughter who was born in July, and I know that it was about Thanksgiving that I realized I was pregnant, so she would have done the same thing. So, and by the time Helen is born, they are madly in love. So, I mean, it happened very quickly, and as she grew bigger and bigger, so there's this odd notion that literally they're falling in love as she's becoming more and more and more pregnant with her husband's child. Again, another odd thing that you'd have to try to understand. And all during this time, John Taylor very conveniently would go off to the club to have dinner while she was having dinner with John Stuart Mill in their house.
So maybe John Taylor realized what he had done.
Maybe,
and he just thought, I've just got to be good to this woman.
Exactly. And I think you have to understand John Taylor's generosity, not only in offering up this, essentially allowing this to take place, but he supported her for the next 20 years. And I mean supported her not just by supplying her a house, but supplying her cover, because he would allow letters to be sent to him, and then he would forward them to her from her parents. He would make up stories about them traveling. They traveled together for months at a time, sometimes taking all three of her kids and sometimes even brothers of John Stuart Mill's. And he would set up bank accounts for her in Rome so that she could get more money to travel with you know, the lover. I think that imagining that John Taylor was just doing this out of the goodness of his heart is ridiculous. But if you think of it in terms of his having felt very guilty for giving her an incurable disease, which he knew would allow her never to have sex with John Stuart Mill, then it begins to make more sense to me.
What were Harriet's views at the time of what we call today reproductive rights?
Well, she believed that birth control was extremely important. She believed that reducing the number of population was an economic requirement. She saw that the reason why so many people were poor was because of the abundance of workers, and therefore she connected that to the need for reproductive rights. And that included, and she was very fervent about this, the right to say no to your husband. So, and that was a topic that other feminists from the period talked about as well.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Jo Ellen Jacobs. She's a professor of philosophy at Millikan University. She's the author of The Voice of Harriet Taylor Mill and the editor of The Complete Works of Harriet Taylor Mill. And that's what we're talking about this afternoon, Harriet Taylor Mill. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, do so. Give us a call. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In the book, The Voice of Harriet Taylor Mill, you write about Harriet and John as collaborators, and you write about the collaborative self. You write, when Harriet stepped outside her marriage to enter a passionate, intense relationship with John Mill, she and he began an experiment in being. They abandoned the idea of a closeted self held by the 19th century and by much of the 20th. Talk about these ideas with us a little bit. An experiment in being and the idea of abandoning the closeted self.
They thought that there were two big ideas in the 20th century, in the 19th century, and those were feminism and what they called collaborative production. And I think both of those imply a new way of being. And for them, the feminism included collaborating on ideas together and thoughts together. And ultimately, they thought that they made each other better as human beings, so that in some sense, I think they saw their strengths as complementing each other. And so they didn't separate their ideas into his and hers. They didn't separate even their emotions into his and hers at some level. They believed that they could try this experiment in living, and experiment in living was an idea that becomes very important in On Liberty, that experiments in living were important to figure out how humans could develop. And they were convinced that the reason humans couldn't develop is because the inequality that people had made men into despots and women into sort of simpering prostitutes. And that kind of inequality was holding back the whole human race from developing. And so I think they thought of this experiment as a way to find equality through this kind of collaborative self, through making a self together at its deepest level.
Is this what we might call today a peer marriage?
Certainly, they thought of it that way. I mean, both before and after they got married, so I'd say a peer relationship in some ways. But yes, the notion of a companionate marriage was a very big Victorian idea, but at some level she critiqued that because she thought that what had happened is that if women weren't educated, then in order for men to become companions of women, they essentially had to become more stupid. And so the only way to reverse that was to have women be educated at the level where they could actually improve the man through dialogue, through critique, through the kind of philosophical exchange that she and John Stuart Mill had. Then both people could actually be developed. But if you think of Middlemarch, Lydgate and Rosamond, right? So you have this doctor who becomes just reduced by marrying this little simpering thing who's only interested in the latest fashion and the latest dinner party. And she did not want that.
Yeah. Now, we should say here that Harriet and John Stuart Mill married following the death of John Taylor, her first husband. And but they didn't marry right away. There was a period of time between. I don't know if that was for.
Well, Well, propriety's sake, it was only 2 years. So.
On the other hand, the bigger question is, why did they get married?
I know. Everybody asked her that. I mean, there were some very angry people for essentially abandoning. I mean, here's a woman who had very clearly said that she didn't think marriage was something that should be maintained. But that was in the future. You know, she had to live. They were both in poor health. Her daughter, Helen, was at a very vulnerable age in her late teens, so her life could be ruined if they had openly had an affair. So I think that they neither one, again, at this point, John Stuart Mill was literally the head mm-hmm. of India House. So a lot of people could be damaged, and it was just easier. I mean, I don't think I would have had the courage if I had been her to say, okay, let's just live together now.
Yeah. Well, I'm married, and I think it's a fine thing. but you know, at the same time, I'll also tell you that when you marry, there's a change.
Right.
So was there a change in their relationship, and how did they decide, how did they talk about, before marriage, did they say to one another, well, let's talk about this, what kind of marriage are we going to have?
Well, in his written proposal, and I'd urge everyone to read, John Stuart Mill wrote a handwritten proposal to her that says pretty much, I will do, you know, I want you to make sure that you marry me, and I will do anything I can to make sure that this is equal. I don't have the language in front of me, but he very clearly wants her to be together. He says, being about, if I am so happy to obtain her consent to enter into a marriage relation with the only woman I have ever known with whom I would enter into that state, and the whole character of the marriage relation as constituted by law being such that both she and I entirely and conscientiously disapprove, but they're going to try to find some new way of making a marriage that's not about a man having all the power economically and otherwise.
Now, here are two very intelligent people, and they're very much their own. She's very much her own woman. He's very much his own man. Their views can't be the same, but it seems that they're similar. Where did they disagree, and how did they work through their disagreements, whether it, and I think maybe we could leave aside household kinds of things, but the world that they lived in terms of the issues, the topics that were important to them.
She was much more radical in general than he was. And all you have to do is compare the enfranchisement of women, which was hers, with the subjection of women, which he wrote after she died and without her influence, although Helen, her daughter, was still influential. And in that, you see the differences, particularly in regard to the right of women to have their own careers after they married. John never gave up the idea that once women married, that their entire lives would be, he at one point says, naturally devoted to the family, to naturally devoted to raising children and taking care of the household. And he thought it would be too much of a strain for you to have to do two jobs. And Harriet steadfastly refused to accept that. She believed that in the new world to come, that if women had good educations, that they should have the right to have a career just as much as a man did. And she's very vague about what would happen to the children if, you know, as we have now, the kinds of issues that women still have about, you know, who takes care of the kids if both the parents are working. She doesn't consider, but she does believe that a woman should have the right to have a job after she's married. And she says whatever problems there are will get sorted out. Hmm.
So in that sense, we still don't quite have peer marriage here.
No. And they disagreed on a number of things. She was much more of a socialist than he was. So she has one chapter in his Principles of Political Economy that is clearly hers, and John says it's hers. They tried to reprint it. One group tried to reprint it separately. It was that different from the rest of a very large book. And in it, she clearly believes that capitalism has to be regulated pretty severely, and perhaps even going so far as to have to promote socialism, which at the time was an issue.
Hmm. Did was her? Let me back up and just make sure I understand this, because I think I do from, you know, looking at the material. But she had an influence on him and his thinking, and she did some of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
But yet her name did not appear
right
in the published papers.
Correct. Many of the ideas throughout his writing from the early 30s had influences of her, but the one that is most clearly a joint publication, I think, is On Liberty. And in it, I give in the book about a 4-page very tight summary of the entire On Liberty's argument, and every single one of the ideas, almost every sentence in there, has two footnotes, one from where it appears in On Liberty and the other is where it appears in Harriet Taylor Mill's writings. So that she wrote these ideas out sometimes 20 years earlier. And so I think that it's quite obvious. And he says, I mean, he writes to her years before they wrote it and says, you know, our next book is going to be On Liberty, and it should have both our names on it. And he says specifically that. Then after he wrote it and he was talking about the autobiography, he says it was a joint production.
So why doesn't her name appear?
Well, one reason is that it was very anti-religious, and so he may have been trying to protect her reputation in a kind of paternalistic sense. He may have been trying to preserve her reputation in general because he thought it would be considered a very radical book, aside from the religion as well.
Hmm.
But I don't think we'll ever know.
Why not a pen name?
They did. In fact, many of the early writings in which you see some of both of their ideas are actually anonymous. So, because anything that they published in London, the newspapers at the time had no name on them. And John used a lot of different pseudonyms. So that did happen. But both of them collaborated with other people as well as with each other. And in John Stuart Mill's handwritten bibliography of all of his works, he's very careful about saying, you know, Bain added ideas to this part of logic, mm-hmm. and I helped Bentham with this. And so there, you know, he's very, very careful about even small additions. And so when he said, and many of the works that he puts down there, he says, either she helped me or we were co-authored. I mean, he almost distinguishes between when she merely gave him ideas and when he actually co-authored with her.
Hmm. For those of us who really aren't familiar with these figures from this these philosophers from this period of time, maybe you should talk with us just a little bit about John Stuart Mill and how important his work was and what the impact of a publication like On Liberty was, and how does it continue to be part of the canon?
On Liberty is probably the best known philosophy work for the broadest public in the entire canon of philosophy, because it has had such enormous influence in terms of our understanding, our legal understanding of liberal democracy. So the whole notion of the right to privacy, the importance of the basic rights to speech and to education, and the value that we have. I mean, the basic kernel of On Liberty is that your freedom ends at somebody else's nose. I think that's the way it's sometimes talked about. In other words, you should have the right to the greatest amount of freedom that doesn't interfere in somebody else's life. and doesn't cause them pain in some way. So if, for example, I want to go drinking and get in my car, then you have the right to stop me because mm-hmm. I might hurt you. Mm-hmm. But if I want to sit at home and get drunk as a skunk every night of the week, then you should challenge me, you should argue with me, you should chide me, you should do everything you can to talk me out of it. But if in the end I persist in doing the stupid thing to myself, the law shouldn't interfere. And that basic notion of where legal rights end and where persuasion should start is fundamental to the way we understand law.
We're at the, what's the word I'm looking for? Harriet Taylor Mill was born in 1807, so this is the 200th year of her birth anniversary. Is she becoming, is she getting some respect, to put it as Rodney Dangerfield might have put it?
Some. I mean, I was on the BBC yesterday, so somebody's noticing.
There you go.
but she is getting more and more known. I take that back, because in the last 5 years, there have been other books, other chapters on her. So I think women philosophers in particular are beginning to, now that, I mean, literally until 2000, her actual words weren't even available to scholars.
Right,
so it's only been in the last 7 years. So I think that you will get a number, I hope, my goal is a number of people becoming more and more interested in what she says.
And looking at the relationship between these two philosophers, this husband and wife as well, their collaboration. Well, to wrap up here, what was it that, is there something that you know about Harriet Taylor Mill that you'd like to share with us here at the end? Maybe, I don't know, is there, what gave her great joy? We talked about her as sort of being angry and maybe a little a tough kind of demanding, intellectually demanding, you know, she's not going to stand down
no.
kind of person.
She loved nature. And there's one episode, I think, of her, she describes, actually it was written by her daughter. Her daughter in her diary talks about walking along the beach with her mother singing Gloria in Excelsis just for the fun of it. I mean, this is an atheist. Right. She was a raving atheist, and yet she was walking along, sort of celebrating the moonlight along the beach with her daughter. And that image, I mean, she really was somebody who, she loved being outside. She liked walking in the heath, and she enjoyed, although she had fairly poor health, I think she loved her daughter. And the relationship she had with her daughter was also very, very wonderful.
Mm. Very interesting. I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us this afternoon about this woman, Harriet Taylor Mill. You really like her.
I do.
Yeah, okay. There, we've got to leave it because we're out of time. Our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine has been Jo Ellen Jacobs. She's a professor of philosophy at Millikan University. She's the author of The Voice of Harriet Taylor Mill and the editor of The Complete Works of Harriet Taylor Mill. Both books, I'm sure, are in libraries where folks are. And
yes, and if you want to see pictures of her and the places that she lived, you can check my website, Will, at Millikan.
Okay, very good.